Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan, and this is our special summer grilling extravaganza.
Well, the whole family loved to grill. My dad, you know, loved to grill. My brother would always get involved. But I was always the one that was passionate about food and, you know, would do the extra stuff, try making fondue over an open fire and that kind of thing. So they made fun of me in Boy Scouts.
That's Daniel Orr, chef and cookbook author based in Bloomington, Indiana. He'll be cooking the feast today, which will not include fondue. He'll give you tips for how to best work a grill to get the tastiest results while cooking some duck, pork, and lamb. The side dishes will include a traditional French dish with peas and bacon, Mexican grilled corn, and a Caribbean-inspired coleslaw. And can't forget dessert, a rhubarb and strawberry tart. Summer grilling doesn't get much more local and seasonal than this. Stay with us. Let's start the grilling extravaganza off right with a beer. The local food movement has a do-it-yourself mentality to it, and this is no more obvious than in the burgeoning trend of home brewing. It's no small feat to brew your own beer, but if done right, the results are unmatched by anything mass-produced. Josephine McRobbie has more about what happens when you decide that the can of Bud just doesn't cut it anymore.
Orange peel, coriander, I've used honey. I don't know, what's the craziest thing you've used?
Mine's been pretty normal. The only weird thing I put in has been cocoa.
That's Michael Ballady and Jason Mundy. And no, they're not talking about baking, they're talking about beer. Jason and Michael are members of the Bloomington Hop Jockeys, a club for people who brew their own beer. I'm standing with them outside the Upland Brewing Company in Bloomington, Indiana, awaiting the results of the UpCup homebrew competition. People of different cultures have been making their own batches of beer for over 10,000 years, starting in early Neolithic times. Modern homebrew clubs and associations have been going strong since at least the 1970s. There were over 800 homebrew clubs in the U.S. as of 2009, not to mention the variety of online communities devoted to the craft. True Brew author and beer columnist Rita Kahn says people are passionate about making their own beer because of the possibilities it allows.
It is a craft that has three basic ingredients, water, malt, and yeast. And you can do so many different things with those to make flavors of great complexity.
Rita makes it sound so simple, but how do people actually make beer? Any home brewer will tell you the first and most important step, sanitize all of your equipment and sanitize it well. If you don't do this, your beer can go bad very easily. From there, the process is different depending on how do-it-yourself you want to be. Some of the steps people skip are the big M's: malt, mill, and mash the grain. The liquid left over from mashing the grains is known as wort, which you can buy commercially to save some time. From here, you boil and cool the wort, add any extra ingredients such as hops, strain, ferment the mixture with yeast in a separate container, wait about a week, and then prime and bottle your concoction. And yes, this is the abridged version.
A typical day making beer, it's about 6 hours, you know, to get through from start to finish. So, yeah, it'd be much easier to go down the store and buy a 6 or 12 pack there. But the nice thing about making it yourself is you can make it just the way you want. You know, you get to try different styles that, you know, maybe you're not going to find down at the local store.
Not only is it a time-consuming hobby, but there's a huge margin of error. Brews done wrong can come out flat, they can taste strange, or worse.
I keg my beer after it's made, and, you know, I didn't get one of the fittings tight, and the wife called me at work and said, there's beer all over the floor. So it just, you know, I lost about 4 gallons out on the floor out of the beer fridge, so that was pretty sad.
Sustainable practices are a concern of many who brew their own beer. Rita says that many home brewers grow their own hops, use cans or recycled bottles for their products, or pick local berries to add to their batches. I read about a beer that spent its fermentation time in a hollowed-out pumpkin and avails that used oak chips soaked in bourbon for flavor. Once a home brewer starts branching out like this, they may venture into beer brewing as more than just a hobby. Many craft beers and breweries are the creations of former home brewers. And one great way to test the hoppy waters is by entering a homebrew competition, like Mike and Jason. While at the UpCup, I meet Sandy Cockerham, a 20-year veteran of home brewing. But Sandy's not a competitor today. She's on the other side, a judge.
People say, oh, what a great job, you get to go drink beer. Well, we have to taste the beer, try to do a good analysis, assign a score, and then, if we can, try to tell the home brewer what they can do to make their beer better next time.
With her new title come some odd job requirements. For instance, no strong odors like perfume are allowed in the judging room, something I found out the hard way. Sandy says fragrances are just one of many things that can impair the senses of a beer critic.
Got to pay attention. You're going to hope you don't have a cold. I always make sure I take allergy meds in the morning, make sure that I can smell and taste as to the best of my ability.
Out of 50 entries, the winner of today's Up Cup contest is a Northern German Altbier, described as copper to brown in color, with moderate bitterness and clean malt character. This winning entry will be brewed and sold commercially by Upland Brewing Company and the home brewer, a far cry from brewing on the stove in one's kitchen. For Earth Eats, I'm Josephine McRobbie.
Learn more about home brewing and get some tips and tricks for getting started yourself on our website, eartheats.org. A charcoal grill with a good heat is the key to any successful cookout. That's according to Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Restaurant in Bloomington, Indiana. We've achieved that nice white glow of our coals, and we've stacked the coals so one side of the grill is hot and the other side is cool. He'll talk more about this once we put the meat on. But our first dish will be cooked in the grill on the cool side. You should get this going right away because it needs to cook for a long time, so consider prepping this dish long before your guests arrive. It's our hobo potatoes with onions and garlic.
This was a recipe that my dad taught me when I was a Cub Scout and Boy Scout. We're going to make kind of a long sausage-shaped package. And we're going to first take some aluminum foil. I'm going to take about 3.5 feet long pieces and kind of overlap them to make one big square. Okay, and I'm going to turn this over so the shiny side is out. Take a bowl, and I'm going to put the fingerling potatoes in. I'm just going to cut them in half. And the reason you cut them in half is so that they can kind of suck up some of the flavors we're going to put in there. If you left them whole, the flavors wouldn't penetrate the skins as well. Just kind of enrobe these with some good olive oil. And this is a time where you can use good olive oil. And to this, we're going to add diced onions. We're going to add a good tablespoon of minced garlic. All right, now I'm going to cut the poblano open. Nice fresh ground pepper. Now, it may sound like I'm putting a lot of pepper in there. It's just that my pepper mill sucks. Hopefully Earth Eats will pay me enough that I can buy a new pepper mill.
Fat chance, buddy.
The beautiful thing about this dish is you literally put the foil directly in the coals and forget about it as you cook everything else on the grill above it. The longer the potatoes, onions, and peppers cook, the more tender and flavorful they'll become. Maybe just check on them every so often to make sure the fire hasn't scorched through the foil. Now that the hobo potatoes are cooking, we're going to throw together a quick recipe so folks at the cookout can have something to snack on right away. This is the classic French dish with peas and bacon.
And generally it's done with lettuce. But today I'm going to use that invasive herb that we've talked about. It's the wild garlic mustard. But if you want to, you could use some romaine lettuce, some bib lettuce instead of this. What we have here is blanched peas. We've got about 1/2 cup of chopped bacon. We're using Mariah's bacon from Columbus, Indiana, which is crusted in peppercorns. To finish off my prep, I'm going to brunoise some lemon peel. Now, brunoise is a very fine dice. Okay, and what I like about doing it this way instead of using, let's say, a file to do it, you can do a lemon zest with a file, is that you get these little crunchy bits of lemon peel that will kind of crunch into and will give you an explosion of lemon flavor.
The tippy doors, the fountain knows, the place is buzzing.
Okay, my pan is now hot. Now, anytime you're using butter in cooking, you want to start with a little bit of oil, and that will keep your butter from burning. Just let that melt. Okay, to that I'm going to add the bacon and the chopped green onions. There's nothing like bacon and onions. That aroma is wonderful. I'm going to add my wild garlic mustard greens or lettuce, and we'll probably add about a couple big handfuls of that.
Where did you pick these?
These actually grow right across the street from my parents' house. Usually they grow in a shaded area. And, you know, you can tell them by the white little white flowers, the heart-shaped leaves. Okay, we're just going to cook these till they're wilted. Okay, we're going to add our peas. A teaspoon of sugar, which will bring out the natural sweetness of the peas. Okay, and that's petit pois à la française. But this time done a little different with Earth Eats wild garlic mustard grains.
Here at Earth Eats, we often forage for ingredients to use in our recipes, which adds an extra local and seasonal touch. But we advise you to take care when foraging for food so you know exactly what you're putting into your dishes. You can find all kinds of foraging tips when you dig around on our website, eartheats.org. This side is traditionally served with pigeon, but we're mixing it up today and serving it with grilled duck instead. Now, something we should address right off the bat is the high fat content in duck, which causes flare-ups.
So if you try to cook it on the grill, you end up causing a little bonfire, like Towering Inferno. But if you do this the way that we're doing it today, you won't have the problem. What I've done is I've pre-cooked the duck. So I've roasted it in the oven. It's cooked, you know, medium to medium well. Cut it into two pieces. Now, what I like to do is to always have two temperatures on the grill. I've got my high temperature on one side, so that's where you get your color and your crispiness, and then you move it to the other side where it's cooler, and that's where you finish the cooking without it burning. The other thing a lot of people do wrong with grilling and barbecuing is they put the barbecue sauce on at the very beginning, and then when they put on the grill, those sugars will burn, okay? And so then you get the black chicken syndrome. What we've done is we've eliminated that by par cooking the duck that we have here, and then I'm just going to mark it, get it crispy, move it to the other side of the grill, and then I'll put the barbecue sauce on. Okay, you can see it's starting to caramelize and brown, and you get those nice grill marks on it. Putting a little bit of fresh garlic on it, put some freshly ground pepper on it. Okay, I'm going to use my special little barbecue sauce, which I call Fat Belly Barbecue, and that's because you can never trust a skinny chef. Okay, and this will really cut down your cooking time, too. If you were to cook a duck on a grill from raw, it'd probably take you about 45 minutes to an hour. And you can see that we've done this in just a few minutes. I'm going to move it off to the side. And while that continues to cook, I'm going to add some grilled peaches. The grill really intensifies the sugars in the peaches, brings out that nice flavor, makes them a little more savory. Okay, and the peaches you don't really want to overcook. You just want to put them on the real hot side of the grill and get those nice grill marks on them. And then just hit them with a little vinaigrette. That's going to give them a nice shine. I also have some watercress here. And this time of year, you can see it's starting to send up its little flower buds. The flavor starts to become a little more aggressive and peppery, but that will be perfect with those peaches and the sweetness of the barbecue sauce.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right, like green tomatoes. Yeah, I'm waiting, palpitating, with all that meat and no potatoes.
We're well on our way for today's cookout. Up next, we need something to drink already. Three refreshing beverages use fresh herbs right from the garden. And our coleslaw recipe will be unlike any coleslaw you've ever had. Get ready for it. Welcome back to Earth Eats Summer Grilling Extravaganza. I'm Annie Corrigan. Coleslaw is a staple dish at most cookouts, so we couldn't resist making one ourselves. But you've probably never tasted coleslaw like this. No mayonnaise necessary. When you use the best, freshest cabbage, you just don't need it.
I've got these beautiful, big, robust heads of cabbage from my friend Kevin Baker. I don't know how he gets these cabbages to grow so quick and so beautifully. And you can see how moist these are on the inside. You cut it open and it's just shiny and, you know, it almost looks like marble. And the flavor is just there. You tasted it. It tastes sweet, it tastes crispy. It doesn't have that bitterness that, you know, some cabbage has when it's been old and, you know, hanging around the corner too long. All right, so I'm just going to cut this into what we say in French is a chiffonade, which just means thin ribbons. We're going to toss this in what we call a Caribbean vinaigrette, but we're going to make it all right in the bowl, so it's a one-bowl process.
Now, you spent time in the Caribbean.
I did. I worked in Anguilla, which is in the British West Indies. This was one of the dishes I created down there to serve on our lobster barbecue. All right, we've got our two cabbages, and that's going to give us some nice color. To that, we're going to add some other ingredients. I love to add some honey for sweetness. We have some cider vinegar. We have some lemon, some cumin seeds, some jalapenos, or whatever your favorite peppers are. You could add some habaneros if you really like it spicy. You know, when you throw a lot of mayonnaise on everything, oil kind of covers up and distracts and enrobes the bitter, bad cabbage. When you have this fresh cabbage, you want to highlight that, and that's why we add the honey and the spices to really kind of perk it up and make it dance in your mouth. Okay, and again, you can leave this a little bit chunky so you get some bites with the jalapeno and some bites without.
The two wild cards in this dish are the mint and the fennel. Chef Orr admits they're not in the recipe proper, but he had the herbs growing in his garden, so he thought, why not? It's that sort of creativity that we encourage with all our Earth Eats recipes. Tell us what little touches you added to make it your own. Send us an email with your recipes and comments, eartheats@gmail.com. We're going to put down the utensils for a moment and enjoy the first few dishes with our guests. So let's take a listen to some music while we're at it. This is music by Bloomington, Indiana musician, composer, and hammer dulcimer builder Malcolm Dauglish. This is his Hymnody of the Earth.
Thank you.
hammered dulcimer player Malcolm Dauglish was joined by percussionist Glenn Velez. That was Hymnody of the Earth. All this eating, and we've yet to prepare a drink. Well, that's easy enough to solve. These three non-alcoholic drinks are great for anyone looking to wet their whistle, kids and adults alike. Chef Orr wandered out into his garden and came back with some fresh lavender to use in our first drink. This is Earth Eats' take on lemonade.
All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to go back and do another simple syrup, which we've done many times on Earth Eats. It's equal parts sugar and water. Okay, we're going to bring that to a boil.
And you're using organic sugar here. Do you notice a difference with the organic?
You know, you can say it's kind of that raw sugar color, which means it has a little bit more of the natural molasses in it, which means that it is from cane, whereas a lot of the refined sugars we have now are from beets. All right, we're going to add some lavender to that. You know, a nice little handful, I would say.
Stems and all.
Stems and all are in there, and you can use the leaves. And if you want to taste that, I'll give you a little.
Oh, that is amazing. The smell turned into taste.
Yeah, I do lavender ice cream sometimes. You can also make a vinaigrette, a lavender vinaigrette. It's nice to crumble up some of the lavender flowers, mix them with breadcrumbs, and sprinkle them on top of a roasted fish.
Add a half cup of the simple syrup with lavender and a half cup of lemon juice to a pitcher, then fill the pitcher the rest of the way with sparkling water.
And you could take it to the table like that, and you can see there's kind of this layer of the syrup and lemon juice in the bottom with that kind of light lavender hue. And then right before you serve it, take your iced teaspoon, stir it up, and that is our summertime lavender lemonade.
Fresh juices are a great way to cool down in the summertime and enjoy the bounty of the season. But this is certainly not your everyday glass of apple juice. We're using cayenne pepper, lemon, and sage.
A lot of people are afraid of sage. To me, it smells great. A lot of people, especially, now try it eating it a little raw.
That's not so great, maybe. a little pine sol.
But when you cook it, it changes automatically. So here's the cayenne. Very, very spicy. We're just adding a pinch. The reason I keep a lot of it at home, because it's something you really don't use very much of, I sprinkle it on my edamame and around my different greens to keep the rabbits away from them. So once they get a bite of it, they don't come back to your patch. So, all right, we're going to add a little bit of that turmeric and a little honey to sweeten it.
There are different types of honeys. If you're using local honey, what sort of honey would you like for this?
You know, anything that has a whole lot of personality, you probably want to save for just kind of putting over toast or serving with a cheese course, that kind of thing. So if you've got the tulip poplar honey or the buckwheat honey, those things are generally much more flavorful and have a real personality that you want to enjoy. This you could use just a regular clover honey, something like a wildflower honey. It'd also be nice. Okay, we're going to squeeze those lemon rounds right in there and then drop them in. And the peel will add a touch of bitterness, which will be a nice accompaniment to the other flavors in this drink.
That's great. And the sage is there, but it's definitely different. How did you think to pair apple juice with sage?
Having too much apple juice and too much sage around.
You just combined the two and figured out.
So I said, let's try something different. And I originally had it as a hot tea because it also, sage is supposed to have some medicinal qualities and that little bit of cayenne pepper. As a hot drink, it's very good and kind of soothing when you have a cold. And then I put the leftovers in the fridge and it tasted great cold, so that's how it kind of happened.
If you wanted to turn it into an adult beverage in the evening, what would you do?
You could put a splash of vodka in it, or you could put some Prosecco with it, have an apple sage mimosa or Bellini kind of drink.
Let us know how you personalize this summer drink. Email us your recipes to eartheats@gmail.com or share them on our Facebook page, facebook.com/eartheats. And we have one more drink to taste.
All right. And for this drink, we're going to use some sour cherries. These sour cherries, we had a great barbecue down by the lake. And then we went over to Mary Wineland's house and picked all of her sour cherries off her tree. She invited
us. Did she know you were coming?
She even had the buckets and the ladders out for us. She gives us the cherries every year. And then I, in exchange, give her a sour cherry cobbler. When nature gives you a bounty, you know, take advantage of it, play with it, and you'll come up with some classics. So we're going to take a cup of water, 2 cups of granulated sugar, 1/4 cup of honey, juice of 1 lemon, and 2 pounds of fruit. So in this case, sour cherries. And you could use almost any fruit with this. So it doesn't have to be cherries. You could use blackberries or gooseberries or any kind of berry fruit. And what we do is we bring that all to a boil, and these cherries were pitted first. Puree it in the blender, and you've got this wonderful deep red elixir. And what we're going to do is just mix that about equal parts. We've got the sour cherry, just drizzle it over the ice, top it with some club soda, and you've got a really pretty drink that's delicious as well, and something much better for the kids.
That's for sure. No high fructose corn syrup in these drinks. Coming up, we spend a good chunk of time bellied up to the grill. We'll be cooking pork and lamb from a local farmer. Stay with us.
Fred Slick from Chicago coming in. Fred Slick from Chicago back again. Riding down the moon online. Bought a house steak and a split of red wine. Fred Slick from Chicago round the bend. Leaving the dirty city was a thrill. Countryside works better than a mill. Bubble water fix whatever. You don't let misery direct. Sulfur gonna heal every ear. It cures the rheumatiz and beriberi, hives the grip, got dysentery, jogs your memory, puts you in the know. Dyspepsia, gallstones, gastritis, indigestion, piles arthritis, ain't no doubt it makes you gotta go. Fred Slick from Chicago coming in. Fred Slick from Chicago back again. Riding down the moon online, bought a house steak and a split of red wine. Fred Slick from Chicago.
One of the great things about eating a barbecue is sinking your teeth through that crisp, salty, fatty crust on the outside of the meat and then getting into the succulent, moist interior.
Doesn't that sound good? It'll be easy to achieve perfectly cooked meat on the grill once you take a listen to what Chef Daniel Orr recommends. But first, let's recap what we've learned thus far about grilling here on the Earth Eats Summer Grilling Extravaganza. We have 2 temperatures on the grill. The hot side is for getting color and crispiness, and the cool side is where the meat finishes cooking. We'll be applying the barbecue sauce to the meat after we've moved it over to the cool side to avoid the inevitable flare-ups that come with cooking meat drenched in a sugary liquid over a hot flame. And if you do get a flare-up, he advises you to keep a can of cheap beer nearby to douse the flames.
I've got some nice pork ribs. What I've done with these is I've rubbed them with a coffee espresso rub, which is we call a Columbus Cowboy rub. We've steamed these in the steamer, wrapped in plastic, for 90 minutes. And so they're cooked through, they're tender. What I'm going to do now is I put them on the hot side of the grill. You hear them sizzling, and we're going to get some nice smokiness to them. The coffee, we use a really finely ground espresso. That's going to add to that roasted flavor that you're going to get from the grill. And so it really accents that the flavor of the pork and brings out the sweetness of the pork. This is some of Jim Fiedler's pork from Fiedler Farms, which is in Rome, Indiana. He does totally pastured pork. You can tell by this nice fat crust on the outside. People think of pork as not being nutritious and fatty and all that kind of stuff. But if you have pasture-raised pork, it has a lot of omega-3s in it.
We are certified humane. I think we always identify our pigs as happy pigs. They have one bad day, and I wish that's all I had in my life.
That's Jim Fiedler, the farmer who raised the meat we're using for today's cookout. He came back to run his father's farm in Rome, Indiana, after working on Wall Street in New York City for some 20 years.
It's just something about going outside on the farm and being out there with all of the animals and the woods and the rolling hills there of southern Indiana along the Ohio River that just is inspiring. It just makes you feel better about being alive.
Fiedler has developed relationships with restaurants in the area, including Chef Daniel Orr's farm restaurant in Bloomington. He sells them everything from sheep and chickens to grass-fed beef. But today, we're concerned with the pork.
It's a fat heritage pig, the large black pig, which is not too many people raise. It's known for having a lot of fat, a lot of intramuscular fat. The chefs love it, and people always refer to it like, I haven't tasted anything like this since my grandmother died or something like that. I remember when I was a kid having it. They're pastured. They're done on pasture. They don't get any shots, no clip tails. They're not any confined like the big operations. We always try to treat them gently and right and everything. So,
hear more from Jim Fiedler and listen to our other complete interviews on our website. Again, that's all at eartheats.org. As the ribs are cooking, we put some boneless pork chops on the grill. Now, these were not pre-cooked like our other meat. Pork chops just don't really need it.
And I want these to be a little rosy.
A little rosy.
A little rosy. I don't want to have them well done. So I'm going to, you know, get a nice sear on them. Now, see, there is a lot of fat on it, so it will create some flare on the fire. But once I get them marked on both sides, I'll put them off to the side and let them slow cook until they get kind of medium rare on the inside. The other things that I have here that I'm going to get started is I've got some lamb necks. What we've done is we've boiled these for about 2.5 to 3 hours and made a really nice lamb stock. And then we have these necks, and there's a lot of great meat on there. It's great for people that like pulled pork and like moist, well-done, kind of saucy meat, and we're going to throw some barbecue sauce on those.
We'll keep an eye on the meat while we listen to some more music. Singer-songwriter Krista Detour is based in southern Indiana. This song celebrates another summer activity that so many Hoosiers enjoy, fishing.
You caught me fishing off the coral reef. Said I was hungry, said he didn't care. You come apart, he said too easily. It's not as if you should be swimming there. Among the sharks and barracudas and the things you'll never see. He called me angel and I didn't blink. He thinks a halo's something I would wear. It's not the weight of immortality, but more the way it messes up my hair when it tumbles down. Wants to keep me hostage in his funny ideas. I want a fish on the end of my line. So what, I'll hook the gill and make the kill and take what's mine. I want a silverback baby swimming in my dish. I want a dead solid perfect. I want a big fish. Says you never trust the slutty sea. She'll keep you waiting nearly half the night. I think you never took a look at me. I don't begin to give in without a fight. He keeps a list of consequences of the things he's never done. Stepped into the tide, holding nothing but a walking stick. He threw his arms out and he spread the sea wide. He said, my dear, that wasn't nothing but a parlor trick. You see, the secret, they say, is in the wood that you choose. I think Moses was a man with a rod I could use. I want a fish on the end of my line. So what, I hook the gill and make the kill and take what's mine. I want a silverback baby swimming in my dish. I want it dead, solid, perfect.
Fishing, music by Krista Detour, off her 2003 album, A Dream in a Cornfield. The meat is looking better and better, and it might even be ready to taste.
You can see that we've got a nice crust forming here on the pork. We can kind of pull this off to the side, and as you let it sit, they call it carryover cooking, so that means the heat starts penetrating deeper into the meat and continues to cook. Also, the blood and the moisture from the inside of the meat will start to go back out to the exterior, so when you cut it, it'll be a nice rosy texture all the way through instead of rare in the middle and well done on the outside. So you always want to let your meat rest after you've seared it.
So the neck is sticking to the grill. I take that's a good sign.
That's a good sign. Here, take a little nibble of that.
I'm a believer.
Isn't that good?
Especially with the crunch on the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sure was delicious. You can take a look at a photo slideshow of our afternoon by the grill on our website. Included are some extra photos of grilled veggies and burgers to give you even more ideas for your own cookout. Check it out at eartheats.org. Let's stay by the grill for a bit and whip up a vegetarian-friendly dish. Earlier in the program, we used wild garlic mustard greens we'd foraged in the petit pois à la française. Later on, we'll be using walnuts collected by a local forager. This recipe uses another item folks love to hunt for, mushrooms. Now, keep in mind that your vegetarian friends might not want their food cooked on the same grill that meat was cooked on, so you might actually want to cook this dish first.
So I want to share with you a wonderful recipe for mushroom skewers. We're going to be using chanterelles that I took my folks out in the woods and we harvested. All right, so I've taken my skewers and I've soaked them in water. You want to soak them in water for at least a couple hours. And what that does is it will prevent them from burning on the grill. Then I've got a portobello mushroom here. I'm going to cut that into eighths so I get some nice meaty chunks. I love portobellos because they are almost like a vegetarian meat substitute. They've got such toothsome texture to them. And then I also have some crimini's. Now, a lot of people don't know that crimini's are just baby portobellos. So when these guys grow up, they'll turn into portobellos. So I'm going to put a couple of those on and then a few of the chanterelles. And the chanterelles have a nice crunchy toothsome texture as well. So they almost have an apricot flavor with a touch of cinnamon. And then what we're going to do is we're going to make a quick little marinade for the mushrooms. Smash up a little bit of garlic. Just lay that on your cutting board. Then we're going to chop it up. And then on top of that, we're going to add some olive oil, some fresh thyme leaves, and then we're going to add just a little bit of acid, which will be, in this case, we're going to use a little bit of lemon juice. And then pour that over on top of those nice skewers. Okay, while we're letting that sit, I'm going to make the dressing for this, which we're going to make a truffle vinaigrette. We've got some olive oil, some lemon zest. We are combining that with a little bit of garlic, adding a little bit of cider vinegar. Cider vinegar has a touch of sweetness to it, so it's not just like a white vinegar, which is total acid. Then we have the almighty truffle oil here, and you just need a little bit. It's just going to give a perfume. It's very, very strong, very aromatic, has a wonderful flavor, but you don't want to use too much because it can just take over things, dominate it. The other thing that's great about that truffle oil is that when it hits something warm, like if you sprinkle it over some pasta or some garlic bread, that heat really brings out those essential oils from the truffle oil and makes the perfume just waft up.
Cook these well-marinated mushroom skewers on the grill for 2 to 3 minutes. It's important that if you're using mushrooms that you foraged from the wild, make sure they're cooked all the way through.
All right, as your mushrooms are grilling, you can get your salad together. I'm using some endive, and the reason I like that is it has such a nice pale color, touch of bitterness, so it's really going to kind of make those mushroom skewers pop when you put it on top of them. Okay, and then we're going to whisk up that vinaigrette that we had to make sure that everything's equally distributed. Of course, give it a taste, and that just tastes wonderful. It has that nice balance with the acidity, the sweetness, almost a meatiness to it.
Portobello, cremini, and chanterelle mushroom skewers over an endive salad with truffle oil vinaigrette. Simply delicious. As we said earlier, you always want to take care when foraging for food, but this applies tenfold when it comes to mushrooms. Pick up a wild mushroom guide and connect with an experienced mushroom hunter if you want to try your hand at foraging. Better safe than sorry is what we always say here at Earth Eats. Only a couple more recipes to prepare before we dig into the sweetest part of the meal, the strawberry rhubarb tart. That's coming up in just a moment. Welcome back to Earth Eats Summer Grilling Extravaganza. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for joining me. The line for corn at the farmer's market is always a mile long during the summer. And I wouldn't be surprised if most of those folks were planning to serve the corn as part of a cookout. It's so good eaten right off the cob with some salt and butter. But if you're looking to spice things up this year, try this recipe for a Mexican crema. We'll be spooning it over grilled ears of corn. Chef Bob Adkins will be taking the reins for this recipe. He's the executive chef at Farm Restaurant.
Okay, so we're going to start with about a half cup of sour cream. A half cup of mayonnaise. You can use, you know, regular mayonnaise. You could use light mayonnaise if you want, no fat mayonnaise. In that, we're going to put some grated Parmesan, some fresh grated Parmesan right off the giant wheel. Garlic chili paste. It's the red sriracha style stuff. If you don't have the chili paste, you can use sriracha. About a half lime juiced into there also. A little bright citrus note. We're going to use some cilantro, very classic Central American Mexican herb. Take a whisk to it. This is going to add a really rich, rich coating to your grilled corn, which should be getting pretty close. And I don't know if you can hear it or not.
That's popping. The corn is popping.
It is popping. And it's okay if you get a little charred on one side. You can just leave it out. It bounces out on the other side. You just want to get some nice color to it. Like I said, if you've steamed in advance, you just want to get a little bit of the caramelization to it. You can get it as dark as you want, or you can leave it as light as you want. It also burns off a lot of those little hairs that might have slipped through your fingers during the shucking process. Okay, so we're going to spoon a little bit over the top, and that is your Mexican-style grilled corn.
Earlier, we made a couple vegetable sides, the Caribbean coleslaw and petit pois à la française.
But there may be folks at your cookout who want a simple salad of fresh greens. For them, we recommend offering this tasty walnut vinaigrette as a dressing. It'll add an extra bit of local flair to your meal, especially if you can forage for some walnuts yourself. Well, or stop by the farmer's market if you don't have time to go out searching. At the market in Bloomington, I found a vendor who cracks walnuts for his customers with a special machine right at his table. That's the sound of a walnut cracking, and then you've got the meat on the inside.
Yeah, see, and it also gives me the advantage of seeing if, whether it's a good meat or not. See, this one's too wrinkled, so I won't sell that one. So this is another way of screening them before I sell them to people. I make sure that they get good quality nut meats this way.
Tracy Branham forages for walnuts at his father-in-law's property in southern Monroe County. As he describes, walnuts are harder to prepare than people might realize.
You have to get them while the hull on them is still green. Then you have to get the hull off, which typically for a large operation, if it's a commercial operation, they have hauling machines. But for myself, I have to use a truck and a driveway. You just run over the hulls, and then when they come off, you take a rake and rake out the shell, the nut itself. Then you have to wash them off, because you want to get as much of that hull off as you can. Otherwise, it will absorb in and make the nut meat bitter. And the other, while you're washing them, any of them that float, you throw away because they have no nut meat in them. So floating is sort of a way to screen out the bad ones. And then you take the ones that are sinking and get them all clean. Then you have to dry them in the sun for a couple of weeks. Then you have to bag them up and let them cure for about another month. And at that point, they're ready to crack.
Hear more interviews with local foragers and farmers on our website, WFIU.org. This simple recipe for a vinaigrette dressing is a great way to highlight fresh greens.
We've got two different oils here. I've got a blended salad oil, which we're going to turn into a walnut-flavored oil. And then we have the extra virgin olive oil, which, of course, we're not going to heat at all. We want to keep that perfume on its own. So we've got a nice hot pan over here. We're going to add the oil to that. And we're going to add the black walnuts, which we've chopped. And we're going to heat them in the oil. They're going to start to bubble and foam a little bit. And what they're going to do is release some of their essential oils into the neutral salad oil that we had, perfuming it and making it a black walnut oil. You want to cook them just until they start to turn brown and nutty, and they will go from brown to black fairly quickly. So take them off the heat, and we're going to pour that into our pan. Okay, just pouring that into a mixing bowl. You smell that black walnut aroma? To me, it smells kind of the wood, kind of earthy and perfect for those astringent bitter greens. We've got some extra virgin olive oil, some lemon juice, a little bit of fresh thyme, some minced garlic. Okay, we're going to add some scallions, a little bit of salt and pepper, and some mustard. The mustard's going to help emulsify the dressing. To show off this little salad, we have some this nice little rockette arugula. So just take a couple spoonfuls. Okay, and then we're just going to toss that. And then to play off the black walnut flavor, we're going to add some local goat cheese. I'm going to decorate this with a little bit of diced tomatoes. And you have a nice, simple salad. Make a great lunch with a nice, crusty loaf of bread or a good starter at dinner time.
Or a nice side for all the salad lovers at your backyard cookout. Thanks to Tracy Branham for the walnuts. Time for more music. This tune is by Slats Klug, a musician who celebrates his life in Indiana with album titles like French Lick West Baden and My Brown County Home. Here is The Snake That Liked His Brew.
You might be interested how I caught this cold, said old Abe Martin, who was getting kind of old. Wait for Doc Turner, said he. Wore the ugliest hat that I ever did see.
Ugliest hat that I ever did see.
I was working in my garden about a week ago. Found a lot of worms scratching with my hoe. Start thinking about the old bluegill. my secret old hole down by the mill.
Secret old hole down by the mill. Things ain't what they seem when you're down by the old stream. Things ain't what they seem when you're living a dream.
I grabbed some moonshine and my trusty old pole. I hot stepped it down to my bluegill hole. Water was greasy across a stepping stone. I dropped my worms, and they were all gone.
Dropped his worms, and they were all gone.
Oh, well, hell, now what'll I do? I sat in the water and took off my shoes. Smoked my pipe, drank some moonshine. My feet got cold, but I was feeling fine.
Feet got cold, he was feeling fine. Things ain't what they seem when you're down by the old stream. Things ain't what they seem when you're living a dream.
Water snake came swimming past a log, and in his mouth he had a little frog. Didn't move an inch, looked the snake in the eye, grabbed him up just as easy as pie.
Grabbed him up just as easy as pie.
Well, I squeezed him behind the jaw, and without a blink, I took out that frog and gave the snake a drink. I hooked that frog and tossed it in the hole. Big bluegill started bending my pole.
Big bluegill started bending his pole. Old Abe Martin says it's all true about the snake that liked his groove. Old Abe Martin says it's all true when you're drinking his brew.
Old Abe says, you might not believe, but that same old snake came swimming back to me. Brought seven more frogs, I'm telling it true, and seven times gave him drinks of my brew. Well, I caught 9 bluegills about a week ago, and that's the truth, I caught this cold. Now, it's a tale of a snake, but I'm telling it true, brought me more frogs for drinks of my brew. Brought me more frogs for drinks of my brew.
7 more frogs for drinks of his brew. 8 more frogs for drinks of his brew. 9 more frogs for drinks of his brew. 10 more frogs for drinks of his brew.
Storyteller Steve Miller, fiddler Gordon Lowry, and Jew's harp player Dan Schumacher all joined Slats Klug in his tune, The Snake That Liked His Brew. That was off his 1997 release, Liar's Bench. And now the moment so many of us sweets lovers have been waiting for. It's time to cap our meal off with dessert. We'll be using rhubarb today, which is not actually a fruit, it's a vegetable. Unlike some vegetables, you definitely cannot eat the leaves on a rhubarb plant. They're toxic. But waste not, want not. Chef Orr suggests grinding the leaves down and using them as a bug repellent.
Now, I grow rhubarb in my garden, and you can see it right here. It has a long stem, almost like celery, and then a big, big leaf, almost like an elephant's ear. What you normally do is get a nice big crop of rhubarb in the late spring, early summer, and then you let the plant grow back through the late summer and into the fall, and that what that does is it re-nourishes the root system, so then next spring you'll have more rhubarb. So you don't want to cut your rhubarb too late into the season. All right, so we bring the rhubarb into the kitchen. What we're going to do is slice it up, and today we're going to make a rhubarb compote, but you could use it in many of the same ways that you use in apple butter. Again, you could serve it with pork, you could serve it with duck, or you can use it as a pie filling like we're going to be using today. And rhubarb has kind of a sweet, sour flavor, so it does work well with meats that have some fat in them. Also would be good with game. Okay, to this we're going to add some sugar, and that will start pulling out the moisture in the rhubarb. A little bit of lemon juice in there to get it going. Again, playing off that sour flavor. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to let this cook down until it almost purees itself. It's almost like celery now, kind of crisp and crunchy. But as it cooks slowly, you can add a little more water if you need to. It will become very, very soft and mushy and then turn into almost like an apple butter consistency. What we have here is a pre-baked tart shell. This is puff pastry. We're going to fill the inside with some of this rhubarb and top it with the strawberries. Now what I've done is I've macerated the strawberries with a little bit of strawberry jam so they're nice and shiny. All right, a couple sprigs of mint, and you've got a perfectly wonderful, easy dessert that just tastes like summer in Indiana.
A delicious way to end the meal. You can print out all the recipes from this episode and check out photos of the dishes on our website. Join the discussion on our blog about what you like to cook over the grill during the summer, and add photos of your own grilling creations to our Flickr page. Our website really is the destination for all your foodie needs, eartheats.org. Thanks to all the folks who help make Earth Eats possible. Aabon Binder is the Director of Digital Media, and Jesse Wallner is the Online Content Coordinator. Josephine McRobbie, Katie Dawson, Julie Rooney, and Carrie Shedler are our reporters. Contributing producer for this program is Carrie Boyce. Executive producer is Christina Kuzmich, and executive in charge is Perry Metz. A big thanks to Chef Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington Restaurant and Chef Bob Atkins and all of their sous chefs for all the recipes, the cooking time, and the free grilling samples. Thanks, guys. This program was produced by Annie Corrigan. Hey, that's me. Support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods Market and Deli. Information at bloomingfoods.coop. Production support also comes from goodsforcooks.com, online at goodsforcooks.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU Public Media in cooperation with Farm Bloomington Restaurant. This has been Earth Eats Summer Grilling Extravaganza. Thanks for listening, and happy grilling. I'm Annie Corrigan.